Support for Soundwaves from the Underground is brought to you by 24tix.com, the most convenient way to buy tickets to your favorite local concerts. Save time, save money, rock out. 24tix.com, your ticket to the experience.
I'm not trying to be a rapper, but I'm real dapper. Coming at you with the clap, clappity clapper on the 1-2 beat, hitting on the street.
What?
I hope people recognize that. I'm not trying to be a rapper. I'm JP, and this is Soundwaves from the Underground, the official podcast of Slug Magazine in Salt Lake City, Utah. Slug is an acronym for Salt Lake Underground, and we're one of the oldest independent publications in the U.S., distributing free monthly issues about music, art, action sports, and performances of all sorts. We also feature columns about bike culture, food, a popular Ask a Cop, and the Dear Dickheads letter to the editor section. In today's episode, we're going to be learning more about the Nova Chamber Series, New Frontier at the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art, and SB Dance's Sugar Show. SB Dance is a modern dance company that has enjoyed almost 15 years of work in Salt Lake City as one of the most intriguing and experimental performing collectives around. This year, SB Dance is going to be working with The Sugar Space, a performance hall based out of Sugar House, to produce The Sugar Show. The Sugar Show picks 5 speed-pitched ideas and gives the creators 2 months to put them together for this performance, awarding cash prizes at the end for the most complete and enticing troupe. Slug writer Mariah Mellis interviewed Steve Brown of SB Dance and Brittany Reese of The Sugar Space about this project.
Brittany, tell me, you're with Sugar Space, which is a venue in Sugar House that promotes the visual and performing arts. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we've been open since 2007, and the idea of the space is to give a space to emerging artists, primarily performing artists, but we do have a small art gallery. We have a lot of programs that support these artists. We have an artist residence program. We do something called Sweet, which is a women's series. So a lot of times we give reduced rates to artists. We give production support, marketing support, and a space for them with, you know, lighting board, technical help, etc. Basically just try to get more art made, programs that will, you know, inspire people to make something new. That's basically the idea of the space. We're also a community space. There's classes, workshops, private events, parties, you name it.
Nice. That's wonderful. You're really fostering the arts then in a lot of different ways. So that's great. And Steven, tell me a little bit about SB Dance.
SB Dance is a dance company, a 501c3 arts organization that's housed at the Rose Wagner Center in downtown Salt Lake. SB Dance has been around for about 15 years, and it's a vehicle really for my work and the work of people I collaborate with. And we're kind of known as being kind of an alternative bunch of gang who's trying to lose their funding every year. Haven't done that.
We like those. What would we typically see or not see, or what could we expect from an SB Dance production?
Well, you'll see a lot of, you know, very physical dancing and beautiful dancing, but I think also I like to say there's a little vulgarity and a little bit of nudity and a lot of hilarity. So it's really kind of pretty entertaining stuff. I like to say we're the modern dance company who hates modern dance.
Love it. That sounds great. It makes me want to come to one of those performances for sure. So let's talk about The Sugar Show. It is now in its fourth year. What is this idea? What is the show about?
Well, The Sugar Show started when I moved here from New York City and opened Sugar Space, and I was trying to look for different programs, you know, like I said, to help new artists show their work. There didn't seem to be a lot of new artists making work. There were a couple big companies, but I couldn't find where all the, you know, young artists were and what's happening, where is it happening? And that's kind of why Sugar Space came about. And so one of the shows I modeled The Sugar Show after is called The Award Show, which was founded in New York City by a friend of mine who I danced with for years named Netta Pulvermacher. And it is now run by the Joyce Theater, which is one of the largest dance venues in New York, and it happens in 4 or 5 different cities around the country. It stands for Artists with Audience Responding to Dance, and it went, they get $10,000, the winner of this series, in each, you know, round. Basically, the idea is it's funding for that choreographer to basically start a dance company, have a season, you know, really impetus money to get them going on their feet. So we took that idea. We don't have $10,000.
$10,000, huh?
So. Yeah, I'm just waiting for that, you know, mysterious donor to show up at my door one day. and love the idea and give us that $10,000. But yeah, we didn't have any funding for it, so we tried to be creative. And first year, we just saved money and basically funded it ourselves. The second year, we took the audience proceeds and used that to pay for that. And what we do is $1,000. We don't do 10.
Oh, that's good though.
Yeah. So it's something. And then after 2 years, we combined with Stephen Brown and we collaborated. And each year we've kind of changed it up a little bit. He had some great ideas and we've changed. And each year a little bit, we've made it better and better. But we've also changed how the award works. So, you know, instead of this year, one person getting the bulk of the award, we divide it up because we felt like $1,000 isn't really enough for someone to go start a dance company and have a season. So it's kind of pointless. But the idea is more that each person gets a little bit of support and a little bit of an award. There's still the bulk of it goes to one person, but it's now divided between all of the finalists.
So you're kind of, you know, helping maybe cover the cost of some of the time they spent working on the process or costumes or things too.
You know,
so
barely. It's really what these are called, are honorariums, saying, and that's just a nice word we like to use in the arts, saying, we actually don't have enough money for you, but here's this. It's like a flower. Hello. Thank you.
That's right. Wonderful.
You know,
a big applause with a couple
of ones. Buy a CD.
So pay for your gas for your rehearsals. Yeah,
that's basically wonderful. How many contestants do we have?
This year we had 10 people.
Okay.
And we
try out.
Yep, 10 people, and we brought it down to 5. So we have 5 finalists.
Now, and they do try out, or?
Right, so every year we've done it different, but this year we did have a change. So Steve Brown had some great ideas about a mentorship.
Yeah, because we decided that Salt Lake, we were kind of adjusting things for this local community, and we thought, you know, it's a bit much to audition with a full-out completed work. And so we decided to not front-load the contest so much, and instead, people just had to pitch their idea. And so they had 10 minutes to speed pitch their idea. And they could, that speed pitch could be anything, right? It could be just talking, it could be a little demonstration, it could be a video. You could phone it in, we didn't care. It was just, you pitch it, do the best job you can do. And it was fascinating what we got. Lots of people showed work, lots of people just kind of improvised a little bit or showed sketches. You really got a lot of insight to not just who they were as artists because you saw their product, but you heard their ideas, and you know, you could tell a lot of being an artist has to do with not just the ability to make work, but the ability to have other people see your work, no matter what medium you work in. And that's just a big deal too. So being articulate about what you're doing, convincing people that they should come and see it, that's part of the deal.
Artists are usually one of the worst marketers.
Right.
I mean, you're either really good at your art or you're really good at marketing. So that's kind of a great exercise that you put these guys through to just be able to, or like you said, articulate what it is that they'd like to do and how they'd like to bring audiences in and how they'd like to be involved.
Yeah, this is all a very real world experience that's different than what you get at, you know, certainly in high school or in college. And then we get diverse people applying for this. I mean, we get folks from all walks of life. We've had people who are internationally known with Momix and Cirque du Soleil and Cloudgate. Oh, and then we have also folks just as good who are local folks who kind of work on their own in their own little corner. And this is a way to, you know, gather up what is really a fragmented arts community here in this valley and pluck people up and say, hey, this is a great time to show other people what you're doing.
So there isn't any particular like age range or any kind of skill level they have to already have?
Nope. I think one thing that was really important about to add to what Stephen was saying about this speed pitch idea is that someone would show something and then they would talk about their idea. And you could see if their idea of what they wanted to do was they were actually capable of. You could say, oh, this is the greatest idea in the world, but if you're not capable of making something interesting that we can see, then you aren't ready to do a show at the Rose Wagner Theater or to, you know what I mean? And I think that was part of it, is seeing, are these people really ready, or is their idea so outstanding that we have to see what they're going to do next? You know, that was more the idea of it. And we did provide mentorships this year, so each person was matched with someone in the community who would give them feedback and meet with them to, you know, watch rehearsal, give them, you know, some ideas, what to work on, etc. Again, because they could be from any skill level and background and whatever, we just wanted to give them all of the possible help that we could.
Selected five contestants,
right,
out of the 10 that auditioned,
right,
and those people are
Nell Suttles,
and she's a what do you have any info about what she's going to be performing? Can you give us a little teaser?
It's a group piece based on a piece of literature. They're little snippets, almost like little stories, which is, yeah, it's
excellent.
Pretty interesting.
And then the next one
is Joni Tuttle, and Joni she was working with facial expressions and trying to bring those facial expressions into a more like bigger sort of choreographic design.
So facial expressions, so this will be her legs won't move, just her face?
Actually, her dancers are really very well trained, a lot of physicality.
Okay, so we'll be watching the whole body, but a lot of the face. So center in on the face on that one, okay.
Right. I'll talk a little bit about Leah Nelson, who's going to be doing a pretty interesting piece. She collaborates with a woman in Colorado, and they've been doing this for a few years, and actually the woman in Colorado is going to be somehow on the phone or somehow part of the piece live.
Ooh.
Yeah, and they actually collaborate on stage in this fashion. And Leah just moved here from New York City. I actually danced with Leah in a performance there, and it was kind of funny.
Oh, wow.
When she came out here. But yeah. So
all roads lead back to you, Todd, just so you know.
I'm telling you.
Just so you know. Who else do we have on this list?
We have Efren Corrado. And Efren's, he's a recent graduate student at the University of Utah. And he did a pretty fascinating work that explored kind of, you know, it was really about his own personal experience as, you know, with his family. And actually, it was great, very moving. Yeah. And again, just super individual, like the person dancing
pretty
was
raw.
Speaking, and it, you could just, you know, it's like an insight into a human. That was kind of, that was really a great audition.
And then we have Transfusion Hype, which are two women here local who work in more of a hip-hop medium, and actually Steve Brown is their mentor.
The Sugar Show takes place this Saturday, January 21st, at the Rose Wagner Theater. Tickets are just $15 for adults and $12 for students, and they're available through arttix.com or by calling 801-355-ARTS. To find out more about the Sugar Space, check them out at thesugarspace.com. And for more information on this show, visit sbdance.com. Ferocious Oaks is a folk rock band from Provo, fronted by sibling duo Justin and Christelle Duckwitz. The band has become a Velour favorite, playing almost every major showcase they held in 2011. This most ferocious of quintets released the EP Polyamory in February of 2011. From Polyamory, here's Cherie.
Oh, Cherie, and what she means to me. Like talking late until we're tired, simmering down, but she don't know she's on fire. Always on time, everywhere she goes, and when she's not, she's gonna let you know, and I have to agree. Oh, Cherie, she's always mooning me, even when we go outside, but cracks there up in the window, and I can't believe it. Always on time, everywhere she goes, and when Daniel's not, she's gonna let him know, and I have to agree. Oh, I told you have low self-esteem, but you don't know what you bring to the table. And as we grow, I hope you're able to stay the same. Oh, she's always right every time she speaks. And if she's not, well, you ain't gonna hear a squeak out of me. Friends, they were old. I'll see you at the old folks' home, hopefully. You're always on fire everywhere you go, and when I'm not, I hope you let me know. Oh, sweet.
That was Cherie from Polyamory. The band is going to be releasing their first full-length album, It's Better This Way, this week at Velour on Friday, January 20th. They'll be playing alongside Cory Monn, The Mighty Sequoia, and Lake Island at 8 p.m. The show's just $6, and if you pre-order tickets from 24tix.com, you'll receive the album at half price. For more information on the group, look for Ferocious Oaks on Facebook. New Frontier is an exhibition presented by the Sundance Film Festival that highlights and celebrates the convergence of film, art, and new media technologies with interactive elements and displays. This year's New Frontier will host panel discussions, transmedia experiences, feature films, and multimedia performances as part of the event. Slug writer Ben Trentelman spoke with New Frontier curator Sherry Frillo.
What can you tell me about New Frontiers?
New Frontier is essentially a kind of event inside of an event. It's a festival inside of a festival. It's our experiment in the idea of expanding exhibition of the moving image of cinematic that goes beyond the traditional form of presenting a film on a screen in a box. It's essentially designed, and why we're doing this is because we want to, you know, we're a discovery festival, so we want to keep up with the artists, and we want to keep up with the cutting edge of how stories are told with the moving image. And in today's, you know, hardwired network world, moving image stories, cinematic images kind of follow us wherever we go. As soon as we walk out the door, we're essentially in a fully immersive media environment. And that's what New Frontier is really built to resonate with, that reality of our lives, but to really look and think about that environment as its purpose for art, as opposed to shopping, surveillance, commerce, that kind of thing.
How long has the New Frontiers been around, and how did you guys originally decide that there was a need for that?
I'll tell you the whole story. It came out of the Frontier section, which of the festival, and that's been around for quite a while. That's been, let's see, my first festival was 99, and It was around maybe 2 or 3 years before that. And that was a section, and continues to be a section of the festival, where we show more experimental works, works that are really kind of looking at challenging narrative structure. But then right around 2001, we expanded that section to start at the Sundance Online Film Festival to really kind of focus on what artists and film storytellers were doing online with CD-ROM. So that lasted for a couple of years. I've always kind of done a lot of work with performance artists who were engaging with the moving image. So we started a program, tacked on like a sixth program to the Frontier section called Frontier Live, and we were doing that for a couple of years. And then 2006 is the year that we decided, okay, we want to really open a venue. You know, 2006 is right around the time that YouTube started to gain some strength, and digital media was definitely a part of our festival in terms of filmmakers making movies with digital media. We decided, okay, this really kind of needs a venue. So in 2006, we brought our first sort of installation, and it was just one. But 2007 was when we re-inaugurated the entire section from Frontier to New Frontier, and then we went whole hog, creating an installation venue that showcased, I don't know, back then it was like 8 or 9 works. Maybe it was 10 works in 2007, in addition to the film section. And it's been growing since then. It started out in the basement of the Main Street Mall, which I kind of like, because it just had that sense of total freedom.
Oh yeah.
The kids in the basement doing whatever they wanted to, you know.
Uh-huh.
And it was kind of blowing people's minds. For those who found it, it was a nice safe space to grow the idea. But by the time it was last year, was really when we broke it out of the basement. We put it in Miners Hospital for a year, which was kind of cool to have it above ground. But the Miners Hospital, the space itself, actually, the building is gorgeous, but the spaces are quite small. And so it was kind of hard to really exhibit the work in the way that it called for.
Mm-hmm.
So when we were able to score the yard, I was really excited, and I'm super excited this year to present this show at the yard, because it enables us to show the work, some larger scale works, and get the whole feeling of what New Frontier is, which is not only, it's not just an art exhibition space, and it's not just a theatrical experience, it's designed to be a hybrid, and kind of busting out the envelopes of both of those notions of exhibition, and it's a social space. So what Miners had was three buildings. They had to kind of piece together three buildings to house the exhibition, and it lost a little bit of that social space. Now we've got it all under one roof.
Okay.
And there's a lounge that kind of snakes throughout, and it'll be a social space that really showcases the artwork.
The website describes events as multimedia performances, transmedia experiences, and panel discussions. To start, can you narrow down exactly what a transmedia experience is? Can you kind of narrow down a little bit more of what we can expect to see from that whole slew of things that are listed there?
Transmedia work is something that you're actually familiar with.
Uh-huh.
Maybe you haven't heard the term yet, which is to say, if you ever went to a movie like Sherlock Holmes, and then you went to the store and you saw the Sherlock Holmes game,
uh-huh,
that's a transmedia experience. Essentially, what a transmedia experience is a story that's cinematic, that's told in different mediums across platforms. That's what the trans part is. It goes across platforms, but the story world remains the same and just expands. So
okay,
you go to the theater and you see Sherlock Holmes and you experience that film in the two-hour setting. Then you go home and you get back into that story world, but it's expanded in the game. So that's a transmedia experience.
Okay.
Bear 71 is kind of like that.
Uh-huh.
You go to New Frontier and you'll experience the game as it is installed. Because there is an environment, there's a live tree in it. It's installed in a space, but you can also participate in that installation or that work with your computer across the world, or your cell phone if it has, you know, the right specs. So it's supported on these different platforms. Question Bridge is another one.
Mm-hmm.
That the transmedia experience is pretty. That one's really cool. It's actually a camera. They're telling a story by getting men to ask questions and answer questions into a camera from a safe space, and then the filmmakers, the artists, suture those questions and answers into a discussion. At New Frontier, it's an installation, so the discussion looks like kind of these sculptures that are talking to each other, but online, it looks more like a social network, where you can go to Baltimore and see what men are talking about there, or, you know, Detroit, or in different places. There's also these hot spots. So it's also supported. The story world continues to develop, where these kind of posters with these QR codes are, and you can take your phone and log into the QR code and participate and expand the story world in that way. So these are kind of examples of transmedia experiences.
Okay. There is also a New Frontiers exhibit that's going to be in Salt Lake, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so what is going to differ between the two exhibits? Are people going to want to try to get them both in, or are they going to be similar? Or?
Well, this year it's kind of worth getting to both of them if you can. There are a couple of works that'll be in Park City that won't be in Salt Lake, and then there are a couple of works in Salt Lake that won't be in Park City this year.
Okay.
So it's essentially the same artist. You know, we're building this platform for the New Frontier artists. But, for instance, Eva and Franco Matas will have a couple of extra works in the Salt Lake venue.
Okay.
That will not be in Park City. But for financial purposes, like if there's this one piece that it really, really took a lot of effort and creativity, and there's only like one steam machine that works that for the Cloud of Unknowing, that we were only able to present that in one place. So that's going to be in Park City.
Great.
But you'll get a really good sense, curatorially, just that in terms of what the show is about, what it's trying to say, and access to, like, maybe 80% of the artwork, 80, and then plus, you know, an extra couple of works that are not even in the Park City. You'll really get a sense of what New Frontier is and what we're trying to do.
As far as the artists go, who might we see, and are there some more familiar artists, or what are some other projects that people may be familiar with that would maybe bring them to want to come and check out what they've got going on at New Frontiers?
Well, this year it's probably as eclectic group in the program as I think we've ever had, because it's, you know, a couple of artists who are from the art world, like Marco Brambilla and Ho Zoo Nian from Singapore. And then we have game designers, Mola Industria. And Eva and Franco are kind of like that, too. They're sort of game designers, sort of internet hackers. And then we have media scientists that are working alongside journalists. And Nani de la Peña is an example of that. You know, the people who did Question Bridge are collaborative, as well as Bear 71. And Brent Green is a filmmaker who made Two Strange Men, To Some Men Strange Fates Are Given.
Huh.
He's a filmmaker who's now expanding his artistic practice into sculpture, like media sculpture. The people in the program, they're coming from all different disciplines of art making. They're not just artists, they're not just filmmakers, there's a range of different kinds of practice that are meeting at the intersection of where media technology meets the cinematic expression.
So do you think the New Frontiers exhibit attracts kind of your non-typical Sundance crowd because you have game designers and different people like that are in there, or people that have maybe never checked out the festival before, or what do you think?
Yes, it actually does. Beyond the exhibition, we have a program of panel discussions where, you know, we really kind of focus on areas that New Frontier touch on that none of the other parts of the festival touch on. And so we have traditionally drawn, you know, a contingent of gamers come to New Frontier, where, you know, maybe last year that panel was completely sold out. We didn't really have a gaming point in the festival last year, so it was kind of building a certain audience. You know, the New Frontier is free. It's also, you know, in the space that it's in right now, it's going to be available for a lot of people who don't have the credential, it's a more populist approach. We're not trying to keep people out. We're actually trying to bring people in and include. It's also built to be a destination. It's not built to be like, all right, you come and you experience it for 2 hours and you leave. You can actually hang out the whole time there, because there's a bar and a cafe there. There's a restaurant right next door. There's things that are happening in the microcinema all day. So you can actually spend a lot of time there.
New Frontier will take over the Utah Museum of Contemporary Arts, located at 20 West South Temple in downtown Salt Lake City, and also at The Yard, located at 1251 Kearns Boulevard in Park City, during Sundance from January 19th through the 29th, with some sections continuing until May 19th. To find out more about the event, visit sundance.org/festival and look up New Frontier under the Film and Events tab. It's time once more to check in with Esther Moronio. She's our editorial assistant here at the office for another edition of the Weekly Daily Calendar Rundown.
I'm so proud of you.
I did it right this time. And this week, we've got a lot of really exciting stuff as usual.
We do. Let's start out with the birthdays first.
Okay.
On Tuesday, January 17th, we'd like to wish Jennifer Quintana a happy birthday. She's one of our distro drivers. And the following day, on Wednesday, January 18th, happy birthday to Barrett Doran, who's one of our food reviewers and also a photographer.
Happy birthday, guys. Thanks for all your hard work here at Slug. We'll sing you your birthday song in person. Will you do that?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
okay,
come say hi to us and we will sing you happy birthday.
One of the most exciting things about Utah this time of year is that it's, once again, film festival season. I mean, Sundance is starting January 19th. You can check out our coverage in print and on slugmag.com. And then the day after that, another favorite film festival around here, Slam Dance, begins. And you can check out coverage in print and on slugmag.com as well.
Where are you going to go?
I'm going to check out some Sundance films down here, yeah. I'm not going to go back up there. Park City is just a shit show this time of year. This is crazy.
Oh, I get to be up there all week long.
You get to be?
Yeah, I'm excited. It's my first time.
Oh, well then, you'll love it.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to meet all these celebrities, and then one of them is going to ask me to like be in a movie, and then I'll be famous too.
I think you should just settle for maybe a gift bag. Maybe a swag bag somewhere.
Okay.
Don't set your hearts too high on that. And January 20th as well, there's new work by Zero Friends at Blonde Grizzly. You can check out some more information about that in our January issue. It kind of happens concurrently while Sundance and Slam Dance are going on. Saturday, January 21st. I know this is one of your favorite sporting events every year. Is there?
I have actually never been to a roller derby bout.
Oh.
But okay. The Wasatch Roller Derby season opener is at the Derby Depot that day.
Where is that at, Is there?
I believe it's at 1415 South, 700 West in Salt Lake City.
And the day after that, Sunday, January 22nd, the coolest kids are back.
The cool kids at Urban Lounge.
It's hip hop about bicycles.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't get any cooler than that. There's going to be so many cool people there.
I heard it's
mega gonna
cool.
It's going to be cool. So cool.
And we've got a heads up about what's going on during all of January. There's an event that we help contribute to at Whole Foods Trolley Square. It's called Add a Dash of Local Art.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. George Gunlock is going to be there. He focuses on minimalism and going to have a lot of very bright, colorful art on the west wall of the Whole Foods in Trolley Square. We actually do this every month. We've featured artists like Bethany Fisher, Dan Christofferson, Chris Rudert, and Todd Powelson. And you can look forward to different artists showcasing their work on the west wall every month.
Well, thanks again, Esther, for joining me today.
Always a pleasure.
Remember, everyone, you can check out more events on slugmag.com. There's a little calendar on the front page, and you can check out that same calendar with expanded information in the back of every Slug Mag.
As well as our free iPhone app.
What?
Free iPhone app.
Oh my god, that's way cool. All right, thanks, sister.
You're welcome.
Drive safe, or bike safe. Daisy and the Moonshines was founded when guitarist Shay Ledesma booked a show in spring 2011 for a band that didn't yet exist. He quickly formed that group within weeks alongside local musicians like Jacob Hall and Beverly Smith. Here's the song Screaming Dogs off their recent self-titled December release. We'll be right back. That was Screaming Dogs from Daisy and the Moonshines. And to find more about the group and hear the complete EP, visit them at facebook.com/DaisyandTheMoonshines. Utah's Nova Chamber Series was founded in 1977 as an outlet for musicians to explore and enjoy chamber music, and it features some of the state's most distinguished and versatile musicians. Nova hosts 1 to 5 musicians for single night performances and on many occasions premieres the work of modern composers. Here's Slugwriter Scott Farley speaking with Utah Symphony principal pianist and Nova's artistic director, Jason Hardink.
When you select a piece, are you thinking of a local musician, or you do the piece and then you audition?
It goes, well, I don't audition people. I mean, I try to make a point of getting out there and hearing people in other chamber music settings and sort of getting to know what I think might be people's strengths and then things they might be passionate about. And generally when I'm building a program, I always have one or two personalities in mind in terms of who is going to be the driving force on stage behind a certain project. So I think of the two things together because I think that matching the personality of the musician with the music is always critical.
Chamber music, at least the experience of it, is really related to the room. Here, Salt Lake has Libby Gardner Concert Hall. What is the community for chamber music in Salt Lake City, and the Nova in particular?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we used to be in, before I took over, this is my third season, before I took over, our home was that lecture auditorium in the Museum of Fine Arts up at the UM.
That's true, I saw some shows.
That was a great space because you could get a coffee at intermission out in the museum, and the space was intimate. But the downside was the acoustics were bad for classical music. It was just a very dry space with no life to the sound. So we made the move to Libby back 3 years ago. And part of the way we made this transition was for our first concert and then subsequent concerts, we had a fair amount of the audience sitting on stage with us to keep the feeling of the concerts intimate and to have people up close to the musicians. And it sounded great, and it was a great feeling, a great sort of excitement about that. But I always thought that once the audience size got to a certain point, that we'd eventually just kind of move the audience out into the hall. As the audience grew, it made less sense to sort of cram everybody up on stage. So this season, and this season also, there are a number of logistical issues with seating audience members on stage, like that the Andrew Norman piece in the last concert had music stands all over the stage, so it couldn't have actually fit anybody up there. So that's also been a reason to make the move to a more traditional seating arrangement. You know, this year we've gotten more serious about our marketing and thinking about ways to get the word out. You know, there are only two of us, Stephanie, the general manager, and myself, running this thing. So we're trying to get more aggressive about getting people in the hall because we really believe in these concerts. And yeah, the audience is, I love our audience, especially, you know, and our subscribers are hardcore, devoted chamber music lovers who aren't afraid to, you know, tell me what they think and what they hated and what they liked. And it's just a great, great group of people to see after the concert and hear what they think. And I'm always curious about what people think because, yeah, concerts are for them, so.
Listen to chamber music. What is, I mean, you're a musician, so
yeah.
You get to experience it in the sort of, I imagine it's like writing. You sort of turn into the thing while it's happening to some extent.
While you're playing.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
But what is it to listen to chamber music? Because this stuff is, a lot of this stuff isn't necessarily challenging. You can just bathe in it, but
right.
What are you thinking about? Are you attaching yourself to it, or are you just letting it happen?
People like ask what I'm thinking about when I'm playing. Yeah, it's a hard to describe. And I think what I'm thinking about when I'm listening is also a difficult thing to describe. You're always listening to the big shapes of things, how maybe 3 or 4 movements might add up to kind of one arch or something like that. But then at the same time, you have so many details coming at you. And one of the things I love about chamber music is that the details seem so so vivid because the textures are transparent enough, because there aren't a lot of people involved, that you can really make out all the voices and how they interact. And I don't know, but I mean, those are some ideas. It's just kind of hard to articulate, I think.
When I think about it, I think, coming from a world that's all basically chamber music, but repetitive electronic rock and roll chamber music.
Yeah.
Small groups playing music on a small scale ambitiously. And what chamber music does, classical chamber music, for me, it doesn't, you end up, every phrase isn't repeated over and over again ad nauseum in a hypnotic way. There actually is a lot of intellectual goings on from phrase to phrase.
Right.
It's like following a conversation. Do you foresee, just in a hypothetical, optimistic time, a place where classical music enters, leaves tuxedos and concert halls, and becomes somehow more public, like it had been historically?
Oh, that's interesting. Because I think, that's the thing with classical music. You never want to come across as being elitist or stuck up, and you go to the symphony and the symphony's sitting on stage in their tails, whatever. But I think there's a reason for the formality. I think it's okay. I mean, the music is serious and elevated, and you want to approach it with a certain amount of respect. And I've thought about that too. I'll show up to a concert, and the soloist walks out, and they're doing this casual thing because they're young and they're trying to be hip, and they don't wear a tie, and they have, Converse All Stars out, and they're sitting in front of an orchestra. It just looks stupid, man.
It's bad.
That is bad. So I don't know if I'm really answering your question, but I don't
know that there is an answer. It's just something.
Because you don't want, you come to this concert in Libby Gardner Hall. Maybe you don't want to feel like you're putting on the shirt and tie and suit that you only wear at church or funerals or whatever, reserved for these things that you might dread in your ordinary life or whatever, that seem really ritualistic and formal. But I think the crowd at Libby is certainly less well-dressed than Robinette Hall and stuff.
Oh, yeah. No,
it's a mix.
It's a different world. It is so much. I mean, the symphony is fine and all, but this is a really intimate experience.
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain amount of eclecticism all around in terms of people who come and the music we play. And I think part of that eclecticism is what maybe you're getting at in terms of how we would appeal to someone with a lot of different tastes in pop music or something like that. We'd be all over the map,
Can you tell us about what we should be looking forward to?
Absolutely. This concert, I came up with the idea of putting these pieces together based on the idea of combining French and American modernists. So the idea was to pair, say we'll just talk about the American half, a composer like Jason Nygaard, who wrote the solo cello piece that is just wild, challenging music, and then our world premiere by Steve Rhones, who's a faculty at the university, is also an atonal composer who writes very interesting, colorful music. He wrote a string trio that's going to be premiered on that concert. And the idea was to take these really recent statements of strong, kind of muscular American ideas on music and pair that with sort of the granddaddy of American modernism, if you want to call that, Charles Ives, who was, writing 100 years ago and composing this wild music that he never intended to make a living off of. He was an insurance businessman, and he wrote this really avant-garde music as a hobby, because it's really incredible, profound music. So, but he did it on the side. He had a life as a businessman in New York. And Ives always thought that the avant-garde qualities of his music weren't watered down by having to deal with the current tastes of the day. So the fact that a lot of his big pieces were premiered 30, 40 years after they were written, sort of when the world was almost ready for them. But, his friends and colleagues who played through his pieces, in the 1910s and 20s, just thought he was a lunatic.
He's the real deal then.
Yeah.
And it's true that in the classical world, he gets the recognition he deserves at this point.
Yes.
But when we think about the 20th century, the radicals, we think of Stravinsky or I don't know, Glass, or I, people, you never think of Charles Ives until you actually start listening. This will be a chance to hear a really great piece. And you'll get it. And the French side, you're playing one of my favorite, the Ravel.
Oh, okay. I'm glad you like that.
It's an amazing piece.
Well, then the other thing I love about the idea of doing these two nationalities, French and American, is that the big Boulez piece for violin and electronics is also, you know, kind of abstract atonal piece. The abstraction of modernism only takes you so far because the piece is so French and so impressionistic and so indebted to Debussy and Ravel that you can really hear a difference between an American modernist and a French modernist. So I love the idea of starting both halves of the programs with these differing views that composers are using similar techniques but have completely different worldviews, if you will. And then, you know, pairing the Boulez with the Ravel is like pairing the Eckhart with the Ives, of taking an older French master and having these things in dialogue with each other.
Nova's next performance is January 22nd at the Libby Gardner Concert Hall at 3 p.m. For ticket info, call 801-463-5223. And for more information on the music series, its history, and future performances, visit them online at novachambermusicseries.org. Thanks for listening to Sound Waves from the Underground. For all things Slug Magazine, visit slugmag.com. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or anything else you'd like to let us know, email us at soundwaves@slugmag.com or call and leave us a message on our voicemail line at 858-233-9324. This podcast was created by Slug Magazine and is produced by Gavin Sheehan. Our associate producers are Jeanette D. Moses, Ricky Vigil, Esther Moronio, and Jonathan Paxton. Our executive producer is Angela H. Brown. Our theme was performed by Birthquake and was recorded by Jesse Ellis, with our main logo and art design by T-Done, with technical design by Kate O'Connor. On next week's episode, we're going to be learning more about the People's Market Seed Swap and Oakley's Crowbar Goggles, and we'll be learning more about former Salt Lake City Mayor Rocky Anderson's presidential campaign.